Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Welcome to Tech Stuff, a production from iHeartRadio. Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm your host, Jonathan Strickland. I'm an executive producer with iHeartRadio. And how the tech are ya? It's time for the news for Thursday, October 26th, 2023. And let's start off with some news about hackers and vulnerabilities, shall we? Ars Technica has an article titled "Pro-Russia Hackers Target Inboxes with Zero Day in Webmail App Used by Millions." The webmail app in question is RoundCube's webmail application. Many organizations, like a lot of universities, rely upon RoundCube and they reskin it as a different email service, but they use that for their staff and students. It's released under the GNU or GNU General Public License. It's available for anyone to download, deploy, and distribute. But it turns out that until very recently, it had a vulnerability in cross-site scripting that gives hackers the chance to actually compromise email servers and user computers and then intercept communications sent across that machine's email. So the attack is pretty insidious. The hackers hide the attack inside an email. The only thing that the victim has to do in order for the attack to launch is to view the email. They don't have to click on any links. This isn't like a phishing attack, or at least not your traditional kind. Just opening the email will do it, because it initiates a pretty diabolical sequence of events. So the hackers create an attack encoded in JavaScript, and that attack is triggered if the target computer detects an error. So you might think, well, if there's no error detected, then this attack goes untriggered. However, the tag itself in the email contains an error. So viewing the email creates the error report, which then initiates the actual attack included within the coding of that email. And the attack is invisible to the victim. It results in the hackers gaining access essentially to the victim's emails. The hacker group responsible for exploiting this vulnerability is called Winter Vivern. In the past, they've mostly focused on targeting government officials in the United States, particularly government officials who showed support for Ukraine, which again points to this being a Russian-backed hacker attack. Fortunately, the security firm ESET detected the attacks a day after they had first started to launch, and then immediately reached out to the developers over at RoundCube. So 3 days after the attacks began, Roundcube issued a patch. Now, the patch does require server admins to install it, or for end users who are using Roundcube-based webmail to run, make sure that the software running is a patched version of that software, or else you run the risk of becoming one of the targets. Over on the Apple side, Ars Technica has another article. Ars Technica is just a great site, y'all. Again, I have no connection to Ars Technica. They just do great work. Anyway, they have another article titled, "Hackers Can Force iOS and macOS Browsers to Divulge Passwords and Much More." So, unlike the first story today, as far as we know, this particular exploit has not been used in the wild. Instead, some security researchers discovered it on iOS and macOS devices that are running on, you know, hardware that has Apple's A or M series CPUs in them. So it doesn't affect every Apple product, just Apple products that have a A or M series CPU. They have called their exploit iLeakage, in a cute little nod to Apple's naming conventions. Now, according to Ars Technica, this attack is not a simple one. It actually requires a fairly significant familiarity with and understanding of Apple hardware in order to pull it off. But the attack targets what is called a side channel. And you can kind of think of a side channel as sort of, you're looking not at the data itself. Instead, you're looking at evidence that data was there. So I'm talking about stuff like electromagnetic emanations, things like that. You know, it's like seeing evidence that something has been there and then reverse engineering it. So it is really complicated stuff. But the researchers showed that through a process that's called speculative execution, which has been at the root of a lot of exploits in the last few years, and by using a malicious website, the researchers could execute a JavaScript application that would then give them the ability to open a new window that was running on the target device and be able to access stuff as if they were the user. So, for example, let's say that I use this attack. I exploited your Apple device, and then it would open up a window on my screen where I could, say, navigate to YouTube and look at your YouTube view history. Or I could navigate to a login page, and if you had enabled autocomplete or autofill passwords or whatever, I could get access to your account through that. Potentially, I could even do things like figure out what your password was and then maybe change it so that then I control whatever account I was snooping on. So yeah, it's a pretty serious vulnerability here. But again, it is a very sophisticated and difficult attack. So it's not something that is, as far as we know, readily active out in the wild. Apple has said that they are aware of the vulnerability. They're working on addressing it. And because there's no known actual live attacks using this method, because there's such a high learning curve as to how to use it, for the meantime, Apple users don't necessarily have anything to worry about. Obviously, you always have to worry about the types of websites you visit. That's just a given. Like, you should not just be going willy-nilly to websites you don't know if you can manage that. But apart from that, it's not likely to be an active attack. And Apple, as I said, is aware of it and attempting to mitigate the problem. I mentioned in an earlier news episode that hackers gained access to user data on 23andMe, the genetic testing service. And the company maintains that the hackers didn't get access on the corporate side. Like, they didn't get access into 23andMe's systems through some sort of breach attack. Instead, they say that the hackers, essentially, they just used usernames and passwords from other data leaks and then tried them to access 23andMe. And sometimes it worked, which again reminds us that we need to have unique passwords for every service we use, even though that's a pain in the tuchus. Anyway, I mentioned in that news item that there were rumors the hackers were targeting specific ethnic groups, particularly Jewish people. Now, NBC reports that some hackers have published a database on dark web forums that lists one person shy of 1 million people, so 999,999 people, who share an Ashkenazi heritage, so Ashkenazi Jews. And considering historical threats of anti-Semitism in general, and that there's been a rise in those kinds of sentiments across the world recently, this is a pretty alarming incident. You know, whether the hacker or hackers actually harbor anti-Semitic views themselves, or they just callously wish to profit off others who do have those feelings, I don't know the answer to that, but it is generally a very bad thing whenever anyone starts to make long lists of people who share a particular background. Also, I should add that I believe this to be true no matter what the background. I try to use critical thinking and compassion as my guiding principles in general, and as such, I object to violence acted out against innocent people, innocent civilians, no matter what their ethnicity, nationality, or religion happens to be. I also know I am vastly undereducated in things like Middle Eastern culture and politics and that of Israel and Palestine, so I know I am not qualified to make any sort of judgment about what is going on beyond the need to end attacks against civilians, whether in Israel or Gaza or beyond. That, I think, is just true as a blanket statement. But beyond that, I admit I am too ignorant to weigh in on anything more substantive than that. But I think it's a darn good start to stop attacks on innocent civilians. All right. I need to preface this next story with a content warning. I'm about to talk about how people are using generative AI to create images depicting sexual violence against children, which is obviously a deeply disturbing topic. And I wanted to give you listeners the opportunity to skip ahead or to stop listening. I think it's something we can't ignore, but I also think that your mental health is important. So if you feel the need to just nope out of this next story, no judgment here. I totally understand. The Guardian posted a story about how the Internet Watch Foundation, or IWF in the UK, found almost 3,000 instances of AI-generated child abuse images, at least according to this group. So the organization says that such material is poised to, quote, overwhelm the internet, end quote. I don't know how true that is, but if in fact it is easy to produce such content, then it does stand to reason that we're going to encounter more of it in the future. So according to the group, people who are using AI to make these terrible images are an indication that the AI models in question must have had real-life images of abuse to use as training material, because generative AI can't make stuff out of a vacuum. It has to be trained first. And that's also really disturbing. The organization also said that people were using this technology to take pictures of clothed children and then alter those pictures to try and show what those children might look like without clothing. So it's truly abhorrent stuff. And while the threat of a flood of AI-generated abuse material is already horrifying, the IWF worries that this is going to make real-world instances of abuse harder to detect, and thus make it more difficult to rescue child victims from abusive situations. The IWF specifically identified a generative AI tool that's called Stable Diffusion from the company Stability AI as the tool that these folks were using to create the images. Stability AI had a representative that told The Guardian the company, quote, prohibits any misuse for illegal or immoral purposes across our platforms, and our policies are clear that this includes CSAM, end quote. CSAM, by the way, stands for Child Sexual Abuse Material. It is unclear to me if this means Stability AI has actually built in guardrails and those guardrails have somehow failed, or if the company is just attempting to distance itself from the ways its customers are using its products. Okay, we're going to now take a quick break to thank our sponsors. We'll be back with some more tech news in a moment. Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
We're back. So here in the United States, a collection of more than 30 attorneys general across the nation have filed a lawsuit against the company Meta, aka the former Facebook. The attorneys general argue that the company has knowingly implemented harmful features, including ones meant to addict users to staying with the product for as long as possible, and that the company has targeted young people, including children, in these efforts. The attorneys general argue that the company's practices have led to harm by promoting material by algorithm, and that some of this material contributes to mental health issues and other problems like eating disorders. The lawsuits argue that Meta has encouraged and profited off of hurting young people and contributing to a decline in mental health. Andy Stone, whom I think of as the mouth of Meta, said, "We're disappointed that instead of working productively with companies across the industry to create clear, age-appropriate standards for the many apps teens use, the attorneys general have chosen this path." And I imagine Meta is very disappointed. Now, y'all, I have been extremely critical of Meta, as well as other platforms, and I do believe these companies profit off of misery in lots of different ways. I would suggest that the extent to which these companies actually cause misery is not fully known or understood. I'm not sure that we can draw firm conclusions between correlation and causation here. So I've said this before. There's sometimes a tendency to say that people encounter problems with mental health after they spend increasingly long hours on social media. However, it could be that people who already have mental health issues are more prone to being active on social media for longer hours rather than the other way around. I don't know where the truth lies. I'm sure it's somewhere in the middle. I doubt it's as easy as one extreme or the other. But my point is, this is a really tricky issue. You know, clearly, we do have an obligation to protect younger generations. That is important. We should be prioritizing the health and wellness of people in general. But we also need to make sure whatever measures we take to do that actually addresses the issue and not just a symptom. And I am not sure that we've identified the issue, right? I mean, the symptom is clearly there. It is undeniable to say that Meta's algorithms have promoted things that are not healthy to various users. I've seen it myself, for me. I have seen, when logging into Facebook, promotions of stuff that is clearly not healthy. And so that's obvious, but whether that's actually contributing to harm, that's harder to say. Not saying that it doesn't exist, but that we kind of need more information about it before we can make definitive conclusions. If it does mean that we cut back on the harmful stuff, or the stuff that scams or are promoting things that are bad, I'm all for it. I would like to see less of that anyway. I just don't know that you can justify it as someone needs to protect the children. It's a complicated issue. And I normally keep article recommendations for the end of episodes, but in this case, I actually have one that is relevant to this story, I think. It's by Caitlin Voges of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. So clearly, there is a particular perspective being brought here. And the article is titled, Kids Online Safety Act Will Censor the News. So this piece is all about how a particular piece of legislation could have a chilling effect on speech in general, even in ways that go beyond the intended purpose of the law. And again, I think this is a really complicated issue. It's one that is highly charged emotionally because child safety is a factor, right? And that's obviously important, but it's also important to consider all the factors and consequences of our response to problems, because we may just exacerbate problems or create all new ones in the process. So yeah, an important read, I think. I don't think it's the definitive answer either. I just think it's something that has to be brought into consideration, and I can't pretend that I have the answer. I certainly don't. I just think it's really important to consider different perspectives before you make any conclusion. Now we move on to X, the service formerly known as Twitter. Just a couple of little stories to talk about today, so I'm not going to do my normal Twitter dump. So first up, X is rolling out new features on the platform that support audio and video calls. So before I started recording, I checked to see if the rollout had reached me, but no dice. However, I think this particular feature may only be applicable for people who are using the X app on their phones. I don't do that. I installed Twitter ages ago, and I never put it on when it became X. So I don't have the app. I only check the service if I use the web browser version. So I suspect that I wouldn't have access to this one way or the other, because I think it only goes to people who have the app version. But other people report that upon opening their app, they see a notification announcing the arrival of audio and video calls. These work within the direct messages system. So if you open a DM with a user, you can select a little phone icon to try and initiate a call with that person. But you can't just call anyone, which I think must be a huge relief to a lot of the folks who are still using X. So the feature first requires that users turn it on with a toggle in the settings for Twitter, or X in this case. So you would be prompted to go into your settings and toggle on the support for audio and video calls. Then you could also choose the types of users that you will engage in calls with. So that might just be people who are on your contact list. It might be people that you follow, or it might only be verified users, or some combination of the three. And I'm very relieved to hear that, because I'm sure there's no shortage of folks who still use that service who otherwise would be flooded with call requests whenever they open the app, and that would be miserable. According to The Verge, it is not yet clear if any X user will be able to access this feature once it is fully rolled out, or if this will be kept just for those who subscribe to the premium service. If I had to guess, I'd say it was the second category. I think Musk has been pushing really hard to create features for premium users to encourage more adoption of subscribers. Don't know how well it's going, but I suspect that's the case. Also, this is related to X, Slack has sunset its integration with that platform. So once upon a time, Slack users could incorporate Twitter and then later X into their workspace and be able to access features of Twitter through Slack. But due to changes in X's application programming interface, or API, Slack has chosen to end that support. The company has also announced it is retiring its status account on X. So it's closing out its own Twitter profile. So it sounds like Slack and X are kind of going their separate ways. In a previous news episode, I talked about how there's a growing concern among U.S. lawmakers that algorithmically driven systems that set things like housing rental prices can lead to an anti-competitive situation, one in which landlords are effectively engaging in collusion, even if they're doing so unknowingly by relying on this app to help them set rental prices. Essentially, software that's intended to help landlords factor in how much they should set their rent based upon the competitive market, when it's distributed across enough landlords in a region, transforms into a price-fixing scheme. Again, that might be unintentional, but effectively that's what it's become. You get enough people using this tool, the tool starts to end up manipulating prices across the entire region, and next thing you know, prices creep up, and you've got yourself in any competitive situation. So now the U.S. Department of Justice has issued a Notice of Potential Participation, which is a sort of preamble into a possible prosecution against the company that makes this software. It's called RealPage, by the way. And the filing states, quote, "The government has a particularly substantial interest in addressing the proper application of Section 1 of the Sherman Act, 15 U.S.C. Section 1, to the use of algorithms by competitors to help set pricing. Companies' use of algorithms in price setting, often in an effort to increase pricing, has become more prevalent in the modern economy. As a result, the issues involved in this case are of increasing significance to the application of antitrust laws across the economy." End quote. Now, the DOJ plans to first observe how an ongoing civil case related to this matter plays out before it decides on making a move. So there's no guarantee yet that the U.S. government will get more heavily involved in this matter, but it is a distinct possibility. Last year, General Motors and Honda announced a project to create an EV platform that would ultimately lead to cheaper electric vehicles in markets like the United States, North America in general, South America, that kind of thing. But now that project is on the rocks. The companies have pulled out of it and stated, quote, "After extensive studies and analysis, we have come to a mutual decision to discontinue the program. Each company remains committed to affordability in the EV market," end quote. So it appears that one of the major hurdles that faced the project has been in the field of battery production. GM developed a battery called Ultium, and this battery costs less to produce than other older types of EV batteries. However, GM ran into production bottlenecks all along the supply chain. And those bottlenecks meant that there were delays in manufacturing, which of course means that critically there were delays in delivering vehicles to customers. And that's a huge problem. Meanwhile, vehicles that were built using older, more expensive batteries didn't have these same production issues. They've got a production line that is mature. So that wasn't interrupted. The cheaper one was the one that just could not get established. And for those of us waiting on EV models that are, say, within our price range, this is a pretty disappointing setback. All right, we're going to take another quick break. When we come back, I've got a few more news items I want to cover. Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices. And that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
We're back. So Sergey Brin, who's one of the co-founders of Google, has a big ol' airship that now has the green light to go flying. Brin founded a company a few years back named LTA Research. LTA stands for Lighter Than Air. So the goal was to build lighter than air airships that could transport stuff like cargo and supplies, specifically for humanitarian aid missions. The first of the company's airships is called the Pathfinder 1, and now it can start to have test flights. It has received clearance from the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA, and the Pathfinder 1 is, according to the IEEE, it is the largest aircraft to fly since the Hindenburg. However, unlike that tragic dirigible, which famously caught fire and exploded, it does not rely upon hydrogen as a lifting gas. Instead, it relies on the non-combustible gas helium to provide lift. So again, the Hindenburg relied on hydrogen, which is highly combustible and explosive. You know, you get hydrogen and oxygen in an environment, and you add a flame, and you get a big flash. Don't do it, by the way. It's very dangerous. Helium, however, doesn't do this. And the reason why hydrogen was used was not because people just thought it would be okay. It's because hydrogen is a better lifting gas. It's about 8% more efficient to lift a weight using hydrogen than helium, at least according to one estimate I saw. It's capable of lifting more mass than helium is. So in order to lift the same structure with helium, you have to have much more helium, right? Now, to get around this deficit in lifting capacity, LTA Research relied heavily on using very lightweight materials like polymer tubes reinforced with carbon fiber and titanium in an effort to build out frames and an airship that was liftable through helium. A single pilot is all that's needed to control this airship. The company does plan to use two pilots for their tests. The control systems have redundancy, which is good. You always want redundant systems for safety. The gondola attached to the airship was created by the Zeppelin company. That's a throwback to the old dirigible days, right? Zeppelin. The gondola can hold up to 14 people, but LTA Research stresses that no passengers will actually be allowed on the test flights, only the pilots, in order to maintain safety and to truly test the vehicle without putting people at risk unnecessarily. The airship measures 124 meters in length. That is a monster. It will initially conduct tests while remaining anchored to a point on the ground, on a mast, essentially. So they're not going to be free-flying the tests, at least not initially. LTA Research already has an even larger airship in production, which is called the Pathfinder 3. When complete, it will measure an incredible 180 meters long. So the plan is to use these airships to deliver aid to remote locations that are difficult or impossible to access via land or sea. So I really like that. It's not like meant to be some sort of billionaire pleasure craft where you can just casually fly across the region, the country below you, and enjoy expensive luxuries. That's not what this is intended to do. It's intended to get relief to places that otherwise would be very hard to reach. I don't know if this is the most efficient way to do that. I don't know if it's a better alternative than other plans, which would include things like, drones or whatever. But I like that that is the application for this technology. We'll have to wait and see if it turns out to be a practical one. It may not be. But I think it's cool to at least have the potential for dirigibles to take flight once again for more than just promotional purposes at sporting events. Tech Radar reports that Microsoft is very hurt when new Windows users launch Microsoft Edge only to download the installer for Google Chrome, which of course is a rival web browser to Edge. And Microsoft is so hurt, they want to know why you did it. Apparently, using Edge to download the installer for Google Chrome now prompts a pop-up that contains a poll asking you, why are you doing this? So the reasons you can pick include, I can't search Google easily, I can't access my Google documents, I don't have my favorites or passwords here, too many ads and pop-ups, I don't like the news feed, it's too slow, my websites don't work on Microsoft Edge, and my reason is not listed. I'm personally a little disappointed that they don't have it's not you, it's me, or I'm washing my hair. I think those should have made the cut. Christina Tarek at Tech Radar points out that using Edge does mean that the user often has to deal with a lot of like pop-ups and suggestions that primarily direct people to other Microsoft products. Same thing's true of Windows. Heck, this morning when I was launching my computer, I got a whole bunch of suggestions for Windows-related stuff that just popped up. Unprompted. Fun times. She also points out that Edge's newsfeed doesn't have a really good reputation. A lot of people complain that the articles and elements included in the newsfeed are lower quality. They're not properly, factual or useful. But Microsoft, you're coming across a little bit clingy, if you ask me. Joe Rosignol over at MacRumors.com wrote a piece yesterday about an upcoming Apple Online event, which is scheduled for this coming Monday. And the rumor is that this event will, at least in some part, focus on high-end gaming on Apple devices, including on Mac computers. So Apple, of course, has had a very long history with gaming, sometimes in a positive way, other times in a negative way. Some of the earliest computer games I ever played were on an Apple IIe computer, although technically I think my very first computer game was Hunt the Wumpus on the TI-99-4A home computer. And then there was a time where game developers largely ignored Apple platforms because Apple had a fairly small percentage of the overall market share for desktop computers, and it just didn't make sense to pour the resources into creating games for a platform that had very few people using it. So there was a reputation for a while that Apple computers just were not good for gaming, not because they weren't powerful enough, but because game developers weren't making stuff for them. But if Rosignol is right, it seems as though Apple is now poised to really push Mac computers as a serious gaming platform, and that the Mac computer is the perfect machine to run AAA titles on high settings while incorporating features like ray tracing, for example, which deals with how a computer handles lighting in graphics. I'm sure I will report next week, which will actually be on Thursday next week. We will not have a news episode on Tuesday because we have another Smart Talks with IBM episode scheduled for that day. But on Thursday, I will try and follow up with this and see whether or not Apple really did emphasize gaming in that presentation on this upcoming Monday. Now, I previously mentioned one article recommendation earlier in this episode. Before I conclude, I do have one other recommendation. This is a piece that is on BBC.com. It's by Victoria Wollaston, and it's titled "The Surprisingly Subtle Ways Microsoft Word Has Changed the Way We Use Language." Now, I'm always fascinated at how we shape tech and how tech in turn shapes us. And sometimes these changes are not really happening consciously. Like, it's not an intentional thing. It's just something that kind of happens through use and adoption. And it can lead to really unanticipated consequences, not necessarily bad ones, sometimes just interesting ones. So I think this article is a great example of detailing how that happened with Microsoft Word. So check it out. And that's it for the news for today, Thursday, October 26, 2023. I hope you are all well, and I will talk to you again really soon. Tech Stuff is an iHeartRadio production. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.